Good evening. My name is Tom Fleming, and I'm a long-time, 40-year, I might say, member of the Society Library. And I'm here tonight to introduce a wonderful writer named Bill Dean, who happens to be a very good friend of mine. But this whole story is a Society Library saga from the beginning to the end. I hadn't heard anything about this book, and I came up here bringing a load of books that I had taken out. I'm a writer, and I, you know, always taking books in and out. And I thought, oh, I'll sit down. I went in the reading room downstairs, and there was this book parked against. It's a new book, and I said, oh, Bill Dean's written a book. He's got a nerve. And the next thing you know, I'm starting to read it, and I read it. I was going to sit down for 5 minutes. 1 hour later, I was still there reading it. I rushed home, bought it from Amazon. It is the most wonderful book. It really is. It's one of the most delightful books I've ever read. And I'm not truly amazed. Bill is such an intelligent man, and I know a good deal about all the wonderful things he's done in New York. Why don't we start from the top and say in 2011, Bill received the Brooke Russell Astor Award from the New York Public Library. It honors a person, and I have to quote this and read this quote because it's so wonderful. It honors a person who was relentless in his or her dedication to the city and who has contributed substantially to its enrichment. That is Bill. And when you look at his curriculum vitae, you see what they mean. He's been chairman of all kinds of organizations that do wonderful things for the city. They give legal services to the poor. They visit the state prisons to make sure no one is being abused. And on top of all this, he somehow finds time to drive a night van for the homeless food, the Coalition for the Homeless. With all this, he found time to write 400 essays about the city he loved. 83 of them are in this remarkable book. And one more thing I have to mention, it was recently chosen as an Amazon Book of the Month. That is quite a tribute. They didn't choose my book, I might add. Now I'll get out of the way and let Bill tell you how and why he managed this literary feast. Bill Dean.
Tom, as many of you know, is a very, very distinguished historian. And he was telling me that on the Amazon list of books recently, his book was number one, which immediately made me gnash my teeth, because when I looked at the listing today for where I was, I'm about number 233,000. Tom, again, thank you so much. I'm a great fan of the ancient Greeks. It seemed to me that they had the sort of key to life in their thinking. To try on a daily basis to exercise the mind and body and enrich the spirit. I exercise the mind through my work as a lawyer. And for exercising the body, I play basketball at a gymnasium, which of course is a Greek word. As for the spirit, writing gives me an enormous pleasure. I gained the confidence to write in my mid-40s by undertaking with a friend a well-received book on urban environmental matters. Once you begin writing, it is extremely difficult to stop, and I have often compared it to a form of addiction, like crack and cocaine. Montaigne puts it at a slightly higher, more elevated level. I have taken a road along which I shall continue as long as there is ink and paper in the world. Writing in longhand has a disadvantage, namely, for me, ink stains. How does this happen, asks my Chinese laundryman, looking at my shirts. Writing, I respond, and I carry these ink stains as a badge of honor. And I hope the predecessors and founders of this library will not turn over in their graves as I unbutton my jacket. Badge of honor. I had to remember to wear this shirt today. Turgenev's mother understood the risks of writing. She warned her son, "I cannot comprehend your desire to become a writer. Is that an activity for a gentleman? A gentleman should serve the state and forge a career and name for himself in that service instead of blackening paper." And blackening her yourself, she might have added. And I'm pleased to say, to report that Turgenev seems to have shared my preference for black ink. My encounter with the arts in New York also enriched my spirit. Viewing Rembrandt's etching Six's Bridge at the Morgan Library and Museum, I see a landscape I know so well, having spent time bicycling in Holland. The etching was undertaken, according to an 18th century Paris art dealer, quote, against time for a wager at the country house of his friend, Jan Six, while the servant was fetching the mustard that had been forgotten for a meal from a neighboring village. The events surrounding that day must have given Rembrandt great pleasure. The company of Jan Six, a good friend who was a merchant, playwright, and later burgomaster of Amsterdam. A wager lightheartedly entered into, a delightful setting to work, an open landscape that breathes the bright and windy seaside atmosphere of Holland, writes Jacob Rosenberg of the etching in his book Rembrandt, Life and Work. The scene depicted by Rembrandt has the quiet, unhurried feel of a Sunday afternoon. Perhaps it was also on a Sunday in 1874 when Manet painted Monet and his wife and son. At the same time, Monet was painting Manet at his easel. I came upon the Manet painting, the Monet family, in their garden on a Sunday afternoon at the Metropolitan Museum. Later that day, Renoir joined them. Borrowing paint, brushes, and canvas, he placed himself next to Manet to paint Monet. Friends serving as subjects, enjoying each other's company as they work. And walking, I find, very much enriches the spirit. On Sunday walks in New York City, I sometimes end up at the Battery to look upon the harbor and at passing ships at the Battery. I'm part of a tradition going back at least as far as Herman Melville. For in Moby Dick, Melville writes of crowds gathering along the Battery to gaze out to sea, seeking respite from their lives, quote, pent up in lath and plaster, and to counters, nailed to benches, clinched to desks. I love that expression, clinched to desks. And Monday comes, and on Mondays I return to the office to sit clinched at my desk. So there are 83 essays in this book, and they all are, most of them deal with New York, not so much the first one. But many of them deal with other subjects, so I wanted to focus in this book on the city. Early on, I learned something of life's complexity. At St. Bernard's School, I was taught by English masters and at home influenced by my Francophile mother. At school, we read English poetry, performed Shakespeare's plays, ate shepherd's pie with Worcestershire sauce, played soccer, and sang with fervor Men of Harlech. At home, Mother did not dislike the English. She never used the term perfidious Albion. But France and Russia have historical and emotional ties, and Mother was Russian-born. So excellent was her French, she lectured at the Sorbonne on international relations. I felt proud when Parisians praised her French, for she spoke a French that she had learned in Russia prior to the revolution. She spoke a French, I was told, that was very much in the classical manner. One of the crises in my elementary school education was when St. Bernard's informed my mother that I had to discontinue French because the years were passing and I was not able to read English. And so they took me down to ethical culture to be sort of studied and found that I had, in my day they called it mirror reading, they probably would call it dyslexia today. And that practically killed my mother because French, in a sense, was her favorite language of the three languages that she knew, Russian, French, and English. And so I became the first student in the St. Bernard's School remedial reading class and was joined, I might say, by other boys shortly thereafter. At St. Bernard's, I studied English history. The French monarchy was not well regarded, nor was Napoleon. French history only became a part of my life when I visited Paris and the palaces and castles along the Loire River. Then I changed my allegiance from the English Henrys, who suddenly became to me, to seem like rather barbarous people, the English Henrys to King Henry IV of France, who sought during the wars of religion between Catholic and Protestant to unite a divided people. I am a shepherd king, Henry said, who will not shed the blood of his sheep, but seek to bring them together with kindness. Henry was a very remarkable person. The passage of years has led me to emphasize, to embrace both cultures. Thus, when returning from Gloucester in the west of England, where I had worked for the summer in a bookshop, as a train pulled into Paddington Station, a woman sharing the compartment leaned over to ask, "Are you in the Guards?" I smiled and left the train without speaking, lest my accent betray me. This remains a high, high point of my life. That day, I purchased a guard's tie and committed myself to smoking senior service cigarettes. Around the same time, I came upon Michel de Montaigne, A Joy of French Literature, of all literature, and Hector Berlioz's glorious opera Les Troyens, and also The Plague by Camus, for me, one of the most important books I've ever read. Looking back, I realize there are distinct advantages in being taught by English masters and having a Francophile mother. Returning home late at night, I unlock the apartment door and am shocked to find books scattered on the living room floor. Has the apartment been burglarized? Nothing so dramatic. A pile of books had toppled over from its own weight. My apartment is awash with books, a testament to a penchant for both literature and clutter. With no cellar or attic, And that's really the curse of New Yorkers. No cellar, no attic. We are dependent on our closets. Those safety nets for ownership excess, with not even a storage bin in the apartment house where I live, books continue to pile up. My books are in disarray with no alphabetical or subject matter coherence. Toss some books out, suggests a friend. Oh, how little you understand the acquisitive habits of a reader. The word deaccession is not part of our vocabulary. Another friend advises, put your books in order. I contain myself from bursting out. And why don't you straighten out the mess in your closets? Tasks such as these, closet cleaning, book sorting, are much contemplated but rarely performed. Disorder seems a part of my life. On the floor by the fireplace, there always would be piles of books, along with a wooden lobster buoy I found along the main coast, an Indian copper pitcher, and my bicycle, because I keep my bicycle in the living room. And book piles will continue to rival the height of the mantle above the fireplace, where will be found a home run ball, baseball from a Yankee game, a boomerang, a bottle containing sand from the Syrian desert, a bust of Richard Wagner, a photograph inscribed by Tolstoy to my grandfather, family pictures, pictures of my sister's cat, a cloth camel from Egypt, family pewter candlesticks, a flag from public school 112 in Brooklyn where I served as principal for a day, and my godson's creation, a clay gargoyle given to me 20 years ago, and the facsimile of a key made in 1812 for the door of New York City Hall. I don't fret about the disorder. Rather than spending time searching for a favorite book, I go out and buy another copy. I now own several copies of David Copperfield and The Plague. But I have one concern. Jenny, my sister's cat. She stays with me when her family is traveling. Jenny is a leaper, bounding from floor to windowsill to kitchen counter with ease. When Jenny is visiting, I dare open windows only from the top. Were she to leap on a pile of books, she would bring it down. I could never forgive myself if Jenny were crushed to death by the 29 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, 1910. Having arranged a series of three seminars on the short stories of Chekhov at the New York Society Library, I am making use of every available moment, day and night, to read the assigned stories, lest I disgrace myself at the sessions being conducted by a distinguished Chekhov scholar. Reading Chekhov on the subway. A crowded subway car presents many distractions. A man boards holding a collection of large balloons. He is delivering them to a celebratory event somewhere in the city. A boy shins up a pole in the subway car. The train leaves the dark tunnel to cross the Manhattan Bridge to Brooklyn. From the subway car window, views of the East River, Brooklyn Bridge, and Lower Manhattan. Alas, Anton Pavlovich, I am making little headway in reading about your stories. Reading Chekhov at work, forget it. Too many distractions. But I do look at the picture. I do look at the Chekhov picture by my desk. By the way, in the back of this book, there's a picture of me, and then over my right shoulder, Lincoln. Not exactly a very original thought for a lawyer, but over my left shoulder, Anton Pavlovich Chekhov. which is truly original, and I'm probably the only lawyer in the world, Russian or American, that has that in his office. Reading Chekhov in Central Park. I watch a weekend softball game. Beyond the outfield, the glorious Fifth Avenue and Central Park South skyline provided by the Pierre Sherry Netherland, Hampshire House, and Essex House hotels. As a late afternoon sun casts a golden glow over the city, I read aloud in the stands this Chekhov passage. And he was charmed with the evening, the farmhouses and villas on the road, and the birch trees, and the quiet atmosphere all around, when the fields and woods and sun seemed preparing, like the work people now on the eve of the holiday, to rest and perhaps to pray. Reading Chekhov at a concert, my brother-in-law and nephew are singing works by Schumann and Stravinsky. As they sing, I pretend to follow the libretto while surreptitiously reading Chekhov. Reading Chekhov in Chinatown, Chinese being spoken all around me. At the table, I read aloud passages from Chekhov. No one is listening. Reading Chekhov at home, I lie on the couch in my favorite position, horizontal, and fall asleep. Postscript. Despite obstacles, distractions, and human weakness, I complete the 19 assigned Chekhov short stories and perform creditably at the seminar sessions. Ah, Chekhov. You who understand how difficult life is for most people, you who are generous in portraying those who strive to live a better life even when we fail, which we mostly do, you who are modest, who never condemns, you who are tender toward those who suffer. Needless to say, Chekhov is my favorite writer. Okay, this is another story that starts with, another essay that starts with a library. In my hands, on stack 9 of the New York Society Library, I hold an early printing of Oscar Wilde's poem, The Ballad of Reading Gaol. On the title page, the author is identified not by name, but by cell number. The Ballad of Reading Gaol by C33. On May 25, 1895, then aged 39, a jury found Wilde guilty of committing indecent acts. Within minutes of the verdict, the trial judge sentenced him to 2 years at hard labor. He was taken to Reading Jail in the city of Reading. Here he complained of the, quote, thickly muffled glass in his cell window, which allowed him no view of the sky. Lines from the Ballad of Reading Jail. I never saw sad men who looked with such a wistful eye upon that little tent of blue we prisoners call the sky, and at every happy cloud that passed in such strange freedom by. Breaking the rule of silence when walking single file during exercise hour, prisoner C48 said to him, Oscar Wilde, I pity you because you must be suffering more than we are. Wilde almost fainted at the human sound. Without turning, he said, no, my friend, we are all suffering equally. That day he was to tell Andre Gide, years later, I no longer wish to kill myself. His great biographer, Richard Ellerman, writes, it was insanity, he said, of which he was particularly terrified. The insufficiency of books, the closing off of the world of ideas in this tomb for those who are not yet dead. In this tomb for those who are not yet dead. With bars, they blur the gracious moon and blind the goodly sun, And they do well to hide their hell, for in it things are done that Son of God nor Son of Man ever should look upon. Wilde's final days in prison were harrowing. He believed prisoner A2.11 to be demented. Regarded by the doctors as a malingerer, A211 was sentenced to 24 lashes. Wilde heard from the basement of the prison, quote, revolting shrieks, or rather howls, close quote. Three children arrived at the prison, having been convicted of snaring some rabbits. Ellman writes, Wilde saw them as they were waiting to be assigned to cells. He knew only too well the terror that they were feeling and the hunger they would feel. He asked a guard, please find out for me the names of the children who are in for the rabbits and the amount of the fine. Wilde paid the fine, securing the release of the children. For they starve the little frightened child till it weeps both night and day, and they scourge the weak and flog the fool. I recommend to colleagues when we go on visits pursuant to the Correctional Association's statutory authority to visit and report on conditions in New York State prisons that they read Wilde's poem, for the Ballad of Reading Jail conveys many present realities of prison life. Claustrophobia, depression, something was dead in each of us, and what was dead was hope. Harshness, and never a human voice comes near to speak a gentle word. Isolation, mistreatment of mentally ill prisoners, the achingly slow passage of time. On the day of his release from prison, Wilde left for France. He began what Ellman calls the leftover years. What an extraordinary expression. The leftover years. For the remaining 3.5 years of his life, when he lived abroad in exile, separated from his wife and two sons, shunned by many and impecunious. He began the Ballad of Reading Jail 2 months after his release. A prison reformer had urged Wilde to use his literary skills to make this, quote, great subject, close quote, his own. This was to be his last literary work. Wilde wrote of the poem, it is my swan song, and I am sorry to leave with a cry of pain. A song of Marsyas, not a song of Apollo. At one time, he had criticized Dickens for being too preoccupied with social issues in his writing. 2 years in prison had changed Wilde's priorities. On November 30, 1900, at age 46, Oscar Wilde died in Paris. He is buried in Père Lachaise Cemetery. His monument bears an inscription from the Ballad of Reading Jail. And alien tears will fill for him pity's long broken urn. For his mourners will be outcast men, and outcasts always mourn. And now quite a shift in venue. New York and Venice, both island cities. New Yorkers may not think ourselves an island people, but only the Bronx and a small portion of northern Manhattan form part of the North American mainland. The rest of us live on islands. For me, the most dramatic and beautiful feature of our skyline is not tall buildings, but the magnificent bridges linking island to island and islands to mainland. And that's why I could not resist this wonderful photograph of the two of those bridges. Venice is a city of hundreds of islands linked by bridges. It is small and fragile, covering only 1,800 acres, with a resident population of about 65,000. New York is large and robust, with a population of 8.2 million. Our city covers an area of 305 square miles. In Venice, residents of all ages are keenly aware of the tides. This is not surprising, given the city's unusual setting. There is a glorious city in the sea. The sea is in the broad, the narrow streets, ebbing and flowing, and the salt seaweed clings to the marble of her palaces. Words of Samuel Rogers. Sirens wail to warn Venetians of impending high water, so-called acqua alta from the Adriatic. Life in the city comes to a halt, like life in the city comes to a halt when the sirens go off, like New York in a snowstorm. New York City is a place of many churches, but on my walks in the city, I hear church bells. I hear few church bells. In a letter from Venice to his sister, Chekhov wrote, "There is a booming in the air because of the pealing of church bells." And each night around 6:30, I sit on the stone embankment along the Giudecca Canal. This is an area called the Zattere. And I listen for what's about to come. The bells converse with one another, the church bells. At 6:30 p.m., Vesper bells of the Church of the Gesuati begin the exchange. Across the canal on the island of Giudecca, the bells of St. Euphema respond, followed by the neighboring bells of the Redentore. Their ringing awaken from slumber the bells of Santa Maria della Salute on the Grand Canal. From a bridge, I see the tolling bells of the Redentore in their minaret-like towers. Minutes pass. Then one by one, the bells disengage from their conversation, those of the Salute having the last word. Night sounds from my room, water lapping against the stone embankment, voices of passerbys, levels, heels on stone walkways, cats fighting the roll of thunder. I awaken to the sound of throbbing engines, of arriving cruise ships, and the singing of birds, perhaps even the chaffinch perched on the crossbar of the archide in Giovanni Battista Tiepolo's painting in the nearby Church of the Gesuati. Through a lifetime of living in the city, I have come to know New York. Through my many visits, I have come to know Venice. Both cities are forever a part of me. Sarah, how are we doing? Because I've lost track. I only have two more. So I've been to Venice probably about 20 times. And my good friend Dick Gardner and I are, every couple of years, we join with colleagues who are sort of lovers of Venice. And we come together. There are about 20 of us. And we have a Venetian meal. And we go around the table. And everyone present talks about some aspect of Venice. And it's anyone going to Venice, I'm available for consultation at my usual lawyer's rate of $1,000 an hour. So I'm going to end, I'm going to just do two short ones, and then this one so struck me, this theme. New York is a city in perpetual motion. Day and night, people and vehicles travel the streets, subways, trains, and planes arrive and depart. Yet daily, we ignore a primal event occurring in our midst, an event making our daily rushing about seem insignificant. I speak of the tidal flows in and out of the city. This very morning, high tide was at 8:51 a.m. While I was sleeping and then dressing for work and later walking through Central Park to the subway, 260 billion cubic feet of ocean water surged through the Narrows beneath the Verrazano Narrows Bridge into the Upper Bay and along the shorelines of this city of islands. The ocean water continues rushing up the Hudson River, causing the southern flowing river to reverse course and bringing salt water as far as Poughkeepsie, with a tidal impact reaching all the way to Troy. Salt and fresh water meet, the fresh water emanating from Lake Tier of the Clouds in the Adirondacks, and from rivers, mountains, streams, and hundreds of creeks flowing into the Hudson. Beneath the water, scores of different fish mingle, including sturgeon and striped bass, both spawned in the river, both departing from the river for the sea, later to return to the river to continue the cycle of life. In mid-afternoon, the tidal waters will have receded. The ebb and flow of the tides, the ebb and flow of daily life. Another great tide impacts the city, far more visible, the arrival of people from many lands. In 1609, Henry Hudson navigated the river bearing his name. New Amsterdam was founded in 1625. Less than 30 years later, 18 languages were spoken in the city. Waves of immigrants arrived in the 19th century from Ireland, Germany, Italy, and Eastern Europe. The flow of newcomers continues. A diverse population has been a constant throughout the city's history. Today, people from nearly every land live in New York. Almost half the city's population is foreign-born. The flow of tides and people, arrivals and departures in the past, now, and in the future. Now, the last section of this book is called Parting. And when I was at the gym trying to inveigle some of my fellow basketball players to buy my book, which was not easy. There's a strong streak of anti-intellectualism in this country, especially among basketball players. And I said to them, the last section is called Parting. These guys are in their 20s and 30s. And one of them said to me, what are you talking about? What does that mean? And I said, parting, as in departing from this life. But, you know, when you're 20 or 30, who even thinks about these things? This is called the Red Oak. Making sure no one sees me, I embrace the trunk of my Central Park tree, a red oak planted in the 1920s on the East Green, just inside the park from 70th Street and Fifth Avenue. It is mine because a tree has been endowed in my name by board members of Volunteers of Legal Service on the occasion of my retirement as executive director. No better gift could have been chosen, for Central Park has played a major role in my life. Before embracing my tree, I first had to select it. To help me do so, I met with staff of the Central Park Conservancy. We visited two favorite places of mine in the park. The first, just south of the zoo. Those of you who grew up in New York will remember, years ago, there was a pony track here. Children, including my sister and me, were placed in pony-drawn carts and led around the track by an attendant. The pony track is long gone, replaced by grass and trees. Most mornings on my walk from home through the park to the Fifth Avenue subway station at 60th Street, I sit on a bench here to write, a tranquil, productive way to begin the workday. On this site in 1995, I arranged for the planting of two southern magnolia trees, FDR's favorite, following my visit to Warm Springs, Georgia, to attend the ceremony commemorating the 50th anniversary of President Roosevelt's death. For a period of months and years, I watched the trees grow and then, alas, wither, succumbing to the city's severe weather conditions. We then go to the East Green. So now we're up at 70th Street. The Frick Collection, Frick Mansion is just across the street. We then go to the East Green. On weekends, over the years, I have spent many hours on the East Green. Many of my friends have beautiful places in the country. My country house, my country estate, is 843 acres. So I spend most weekends in Central Park, partly because I'm a rather difficult weekend guest, but also I like it. We then go to the East Green. On weekends over the years, I have spent many hours on the East Green, seated on the grass, leaning against the rough bark of a red oak where I write and read. From here, I see the Frick Mansion and the facades of Fifth Avenue apartment buildings. So this is a tree. This is not just a tree. This is a tree that's played a role in my life. This red oak is a proud, handsome tree, standing 60 feet tall. Its broad canopy has long provided me with beneficial shade. I select the red oak as my tree. On hot summer days, I will continue to enjoy its shade and listen to the sounds of its swaying branches. At night, I will watch fireflies dart around the trunk. For those of you who may not be in this New York during the summer, Central Park is ablaze with fireflies. At night, I will watch fireflies dart around the trunk. In the fall, I will admire its bright orange leaves. Every other year, I will collect the acorns it sheds. In winter, I will visit my tree as it braves the elements. The Portuguese writer José Saramago, in Small Memories, a memoir, describes his father, late in life, going, quote, from tree to tree in his garden, embracing their trunks and saying goodbye to them, to their friendly shade, to the fruits he will never eat again. Late in my life, when the end is near, I will do the same. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for a very generous reception. Sarah? So where are we now? Okay, if we can do questions, or we can, and questions, love to answer questions. So are there any questions? Yes, ma'am.
Have any schools or universities in New York City adhered themselves to you?
Adhered themselves to me?
Adhered.
I'm missing the verb.
Indeed.
In other words, have I taught?
Like when you go into the park, you mentioned like the connotation of going into a special place in the park.
Yes.
Or about the bridge.
Yes.
Or rivers.
Yeah.
But is there any institution?
Well, the two institutions that I attended in New York, one was St. Bernard's School, very strict school, but boy, oh boy, did they drill the English language into us, for which I'm forever grateful. I've done a fair amount of teaching myself over the years, and if a person can speak and if a person can write, I really feel they're 87% along the way. And then I had a very strange relationship with the New York Society Library, because for 3 years I took the crosstown bus to Collegiate School, And I was not very much into books or studying or anything. And so I would stand under the awning whenever it rained. And years later, someone said, you know, did you know that that's a library? And I said, no. And then a friend of mine was handling an estate, and they had a library share, and there was no place to go. She said, so I can either return it to the library or I can give it to you. And it has really changed my life. I feel very close to St. Bernard's. I feel very close to Collegiate. I feel very close to the New York Society Library. And just really to I was sent away for 1 year at boarding school, and I told my mother that I was not returning, that Hercules lifts Antaeus off the ground, and all Antaeus's strength comes from his contact with the ground, and I am, you know, just a hopeless New Yorker, which is another form of addiction. Yes, ma'am.
I was very touched by your piece about your tree in New York.
Yes, thank you.
Park. And so many of us are transported from other states and other cities. And yet my late husband was a born and raised New Yorker. And when we walked in Central Park, he would point out the rock from which he fell and
yes.
broke his leg.
Yes. Yes. Well, and I'd love to just tell you a story that Tchaikovsky came to this country for the opening of Carnegie Hall. And he was staying with Shermer, the music publisher, who had a large apartment in the Dakota. And Tchaikovsky would look out of the living room window and see this park. And he was Russian. And remember, Russians think big. And he thought that Central Park was Shermer's private estate. And for a wealthy Russian, 843 acres is nothing. Yes, sir. I really don't remember the day. I do remember the earthquake in New York, which was a Saturday morning, about 30 years ago. But I'm letting you down. Don't you find that here we are daily walking along the streets, and doing our errands and going to work, with absolutely no concept of the energy that's taking place in the rivers, in these tidal waters. So unlike the Venetians, by the way, who are totally aware. And if some person could come up with an invention to somehow generate electricity from underneath the Verrazano Bridge, I think we could withdraw from the Middle East forever. So, yes.
I was interested. I wanted to ask you this, Bill. What do you think of the Highliner? Have you gone down and looked at that?
The High Line?
The Highliner. You know, the walk that they
built down there. Yes. Yes. I enjoy it. I can't say I get that excited about it, but I'm 76 years old, Tom, and my level of excitement is vastly diminished. So look, yes, ma'am.
Yes, I have a suggestion. If you ever tire of being in Central Park in the summer, that flows on over, you take the subway to Brighton Beach. First you check the high tide, but there the draw is not too steep, unlike Long Island Sound, so you can swim most of the time. So you have expanded your feeling of New York, and that Central Park is your own living room, and now you have your own swimming pool. By just going on the subway to Brighton Beach, where preferably disrobe and swim. I have seen some Muslim women swimming with costume, but they do look kind of soggy at the end.
And I can be with my people, namely the Russians.
Yes, definitely.
At least half my people. The other half is. It's what?
They have some Russian restaurants.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you use your imagination, you can even pretend you're the soccer.
But I have a feeling that having been born and raised in this city, I think I've probably been to every beach in the city. So I want to just leave with the upper hand. But I appreciate the thought. But this city of ours is so extraordinary. And when I sort of hold myself out as a great authority on New York City, I'm really such a phony, because my real authoritative nature or knowledge is based pretty much on from 105th Street, where I was born, to the Battery. And there's so many parts of Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx and Staten Island that I don't know. But we're very lucky to live in this city, even though it is a very difficult place for so many people. So look, I think this is probably a good time to end, and so thank you very much.